Well, good morning, Your Honors. Ashish Desai on behalf of the appellant, Eddie Silva. I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll keep track of my time.
Very well.
You know, at heart, what we have here is a quintessential issue of fact. The question is, what did the employer know here? And what are the factors that we have? So, as you know, the district court said, well, the employer really didn't know that his drivers were working this non-productive time, and as a result, they didn't have to pay for that. Well, so what do we have as far as the facts go? Well, the first thing we have is that we knew that the employer, Domino's, put together this piece rate compensation plan, which by definition results in productive and non-productive time. We know that, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But we also know that the employer demanded this pre-shift and post-shift work. We pointed to this handbook, and we also pointed to, you know, this list that it had for all the things you had to do pre-shift, and then the list of things you had to do post-shift. We said that showed that, you know, their prepayment of time was inadequate. We said that's another factor in our cap to show that. Well, but then we come to the issue of, well, how does the employer know? What does Domino's know? Well, to me, here is the quintessential issue of fact. Our client, Eddie Silva, testified that they had driver meetings. He and four other guys, they had driver meetings with the manager. And they say, hey, this 15 minutes isn't enough time to get the job done. We can't get it done. Well, the response of management was, well, too bad. Domino's pays you 15 minutes for it. You're a pro. Go get it done however you can get it done. So we've not only got that, we've got two managers that we pointed out observed our client doing this kind of work. We've got three other drivers who basically come in with Me Too evidence, right? All three of them say we were drivers. We underwent the exact same thing that Mr. Silva went through. So, really, and at the end of
I hate to interrupt your argument, but you're basically repeating what you said in your brief, and we've read the briefs. But let me just ask you this. Why haven't you waived the claim that Domino's compensation scheme is based on an unreasonable estimate by not arguing it in your opening brief?
It's based on an unreasonable estimate. That wasn't the point, because the court never got to that issue. The court said that whether the estimate is good or bad is a question of fact, and I'm not going to get to that issue. The district court never answered that question. That's why we didn't.
But again, I respectfully understand what you're saying, but I'm saying, did you raise that issue in your opening brief?
No.
Nowhere. Okay, isn't that aspect, I mean, you've got a lot of aspects of this case, but isn't that aspect waived then?
Sure. We don't need that.
Okay.
That's not the point. The point is this a question of fact, whether the employer knows that its employees, in this particular case, Mr. Silva, if he is working productive and non-productive work, and hasn't taken steps to ensure that? Well, we say that it did. This is a good old-fashioned dogfight. We got a lot of good arguments on our side. They've got some on their side. This should have gone to a jury. This isn't a point where the district court gets to come in there and say, well, no, you're...
And you may very well have that correct, and we'll talk to your opponent about that. But let me ask you this. What's the basis of the district court's jurisdiction in this case? Is there still a CAFA jurisdiction when the complaint no longer pleads a class action claim?
Judge Smith, I knew this would come up somehow, right?
That's well.
We have briefed this. I understand the court is concerned. I was concerned about it at some point as well. The question becomes, look, when do you look at jurisdiction? At some point, does the district court have jurisdiction? Yes, it did in this particular case. Then, at some point, did the court lose jurisdiction? Possibly, but it held on to it through supplemental jurisdiction. It felt it had enough work done in the case. The parties put in enough work in this case that it could issue an order. Having done all of that, it did render supplemental jurisdiction. Now, here's the good news as a practical matter. As a good news, the Ninth Circuit in a unrelated, in a related issue in Carmona versus Domino's, of which all the same lawyers that are here before you were over there, the court issued a ruling that said that the arbitration agreement in that case is invalid because of all kinds of reasons. So in other words, we're going to get CAFA jurisdiction all over again in this case when this case gets remanded one way or the other back to the district court.
In the interim period?
In the interim period, we argued supplemental jurisdiction. We hope the court buys it.
If we don't?
If you don't, then nook pro tunk to everything we did is a wash, and we all wasted our times for 2 years.
That would be very sad.
Believe me, it would. It is not my first choice. And the irony of all ironies is that I guess that the district court's order on summary judgment would be vacated because it never had jurisdiction either. So then my clients get a fresh claim. So I guess we file back in state court with the labor code claims now that we have this district court ruling in Carmona versus Domino's, and we end up right back to federal court, and I guess we do it all over again. But I certainly hope it doesn't come to that.
I'm not saying it will. I'm just asking you.
Yeah, no, that is the effect of it, Your Honor. You hit the nail right on the head, and that's procedurally precisely what would happen. So
if you were us, what would you do?
I would say the district court had supplemental jurisdiction. I'd look at the facts here and say it's a quintessential issue of fact as to whether the employer has knowledge, and you got to let Mr. Desai have his day in front of a jury.
So, but what you're saying is, let's just assume we got jurisdiction and we need to go back because there are factual issues.
Say that again.
So what you're saying is, let's just assume the district court had jurisdiction, and if the court has that, then you need to go to the jury, right?
That's right. That's okay. Right. Yeah. Presupposing that the supplemental jurisdiction argument that we have briefed, the Ninth Circuit is willing to buy. The Ninth Circuit says, no, you're wrong on that. The district court never had jurisdiction. Well, then I suppose the court would have to vacate the district court's order, even on summary judgment, in which case nothing, I guess it becomes a legal novelty, a non-pro-tunk, nothing ever happened. It is exist as if Dorothy, clicked her heels and it was all a dream. At any rate, let's assume that we get past that and I get my appeal here. I'd like to go back to the issue of, I know I'm repeating certain things that were in the brief, but one of the things I really do want to point out is that the district court never commented on that. In other words, if it would have said, we know you have, and the driver meetings is a perfect example. Okay, our guy said he had a meeting where they talked about this. There were two managers. They said, we're not going to pay for it. So he says, look, I didn't write it down on my timesheet because why would I? I'm not getting paid for it. I mean, why am I going to write it down when he already told me I'm not getting paid for it? So those were his explanations in his deposition transcript. Of course, the defense took that to say, hey, you falsified your records. And if you falsify records, then, we don't know about it and we could never figure it out. And we shouldn't be liable for the wage claims. I'll give you one more point on this, which is another issue of why the district court did not comply with the law, because there was a burden shifting that happened here. In this case, under Anderson versus Mount Clemens, there were no records of this time, of the particular time we're talking about, the actual work records of when the wheels were not rolling, the non-productive time. They claim it was the drivers that were supposed to keep those records. But you can't do that. It's a non-delegable duty. It's a duty that the employer has that you can't shift on to somebody else. And so in Anderson, it said that when you don't have those kind of records, what do you do? But what you do is you provide a very lenient burden for the employee. And in this particular case, and what that really means in the real world is that the employee's testimony governs. It rules. And if the employer doesn't have the records to, you know, to dissuade what the employee's saying, well, it's his own fault because he's the one that's supposed to keep these records. And we know that after the Supreme Court ruled even in Troster versus Starbucks, that even small amounts of time, the employer is supposed to figure out a way to track that time. And in today's world, it's not that hard, I'll tell you. You know, you can get cell phone apps. You can get GPS trackers, which are, by the way, on every one of these trucks, they already have the GPS trackers. So they could, if they wanted to, pull those records and say, hey, we know that this stop took this long because the wheels weren't rolling, then they started rolling, and they could sync all of that up throughout the day. They choose not to.
The district court on summary judgment really isn't entitled to much deference, and I think we have to look at the factual issues de novo here. But on the unpaid wages claim, it doesn't seem to me that Silva went uncompensated in any way whatsoever. He never informed Domino's that he was working off the clock, and his managers never directed him to work off the clock. On that discrete claim, why wasn't the district court absolutely correct in terms of entering summary judgment? Because it doesn't seem like Mr. Silva could possibly adduce any evidence to the jury that would substantiate that he had unpaid wages.
Because there's no requirement that you have to tell your boss that you've worked this time. There's no, particularly when he tells you, he did tell people. The fact of the matter is that he told two of his managers at this employee meeting, hey, I can't get this done in 15 minutes. It's taking much longer than that. Three other drivers said, yeah, that's right. We can't get it done in 15 minutes. He went to his deposition, even though they automatically only pay for 30 minutes. They're the ones who came up with this argument that, well, if you work more time, then you let us know, and we'll pay you for that. Well, that wasn't a real policy. Our guys say that never happened.
But, well, didn't Mr. Silva actually get paid on the basis of the extra time and at the $20 rate?
He did not. Well, they only paid him this.
That's not what the record shows, if I understand it correctly.
That's not true, because it was every paper. They say that you didn't write down. What you don't write down, you don't get paid for at Domino's. It's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. They tell them that we're only going to pay you a flat rate for all this.
I'm looking at ER 216 through 21. That showed that your client occasionally did record additional time at Domino's, compensated him for it at an hourly rate of $20.
Yeah, that's when the truck was delayed an hour.
Right. When he made the claim, he got paid $20 an hour, right?
Yeah, for the truck being delayed, not for pre-shift, post-shift. For pre-shift, post-shift is a completely different argument. So what I'm saying is that whether you believe him or not, whether you say, oh, this guy's a big fat liar, you know, he should have reported his time. None of those are requirements to wage and hour law. Under wage and hour law, it's a strict liability statute. If you suffer or permit the work, whether you like the driver or not, whether he is sloppy work, whatever it is, the wage and hour law say you have to pay for it, and you don't have to ask for it. You don't have to tell your employer about it. And in this particular case, he tried to tell his employer about it. His employer said, you're not getting paid for it.
Counsel,
so why would he write it down?
Your time? You don't have much left. You want to save it?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Mr. Piesco, please.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, and may it please the court. Your Honor, Judge Smith, I think you hit the nail on the head here. And in the context of the review of a case on summary judgment, we all recognize it's de novo. But I would respectfully submit that Judge Selma at the district court level completely got this right. And the reason he got it right is severalfold. First of all, as the court itself acknowledged and has seen in the record, The record is replete with evidence that Mr. Silva never complained about off-the-clock work. It's replete with evidence that he admitted and understood Domino's policy, its strict policy prohibiting off-the-clock work. He admitted that it was quote-unquote on him, that it was his obligation under Domino's timekeeping policies to accurately record his time, and he chose not to do so. And that precisely is, with respect to the court, I'd submit, what those trip sheets are for. And we've seen evidence replete throughout the record that not only Mr. Silva, but his three declarants, which I'll get to in a second because I'm sure the court has some questions on that, but that his three declarants did put in extra non-productive downtime and were paid for it, which was directly contrary to their declarations that were submitted in response to Domino's motion for summary judgment. In fact, I point the court to volume 2 ER 220, which is a specific example of Mr. Silva putting in extra downtime at $20 an hour with respect to the very work which he claims he worked off the clock. That's the login paperwork for pre-shift duties. So we know in this case, Your Honors, that there's no actual knowledge. There's nothing in this record to show Domino's actually knew, as he alleges that he or any other drivers.
Let me ask you this, counsel. I, in connection with part of the claim, I totally understand, but I did find in the record several things that suggested to me that it, at least possibly a jury question about how much Domino's knew. And I'm just going in a summary way. First of all, it was a large amount of work. Secondly, the amount of time employees actually spent completing the tasks. Silva presented evidence that he and other drivers spent more than 30 minutes completing pre- and post-op tasks. Next, the drivers complained about working off the clock at meetings with Domino's managers. Next, the managers encouraged the drivers to not record the additional time beyond the 30 minutes. There were three drivers that said that, and that drivers felt pressure around the DOT's 14-hour rule. Now, I know you disagree with all those things, but the reality is these were things that were alleged by Mr. Silva and others. Why is not that aspect something that would be inappropriate for summary judgment? Not the whole claim, but just that portion.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I completely understand the question. So in this case, I respectfully submit that the district court didn't engage in any weighing or making any credibility determinations. And the reason why is several. First of all, Your Honor, the record does not show, with all due respect, that any of these declarants, quote unquote, complained to anybody. What the declarants, only two of the declarants, by the way, Mr. Mendoza and Mr. Carmona, testified quite artfully that off-the-clock work, quote-unquote, was, quote-unquote, talked about at these meetings at which unidentified managers were present. There wasn't any complaint. And the reason why it was written that way was because if you look at ER 159, which is page 9 of Mr. Silva's testimony, he was directly asked, well, what happened at these meetings? What did you say? And his response was, we didn't phrase it that way. What we said was, the way we word it, quote unquote, is that we did not have enough time in the day to do everything we needed to do. That hardly was a complaint. And he testified repeatedly in response to my questioning that he never complained to anybody. And this is important, Your Honor, because the reason why it did not create a genuine issue of triable fact here, and the reason Judge Selna found that the proof was not competent, was because each of these drivers' declarations, as well as Mr. Silva's, was blatantly contradicted by their own words and by the written on the timesheets where they put it in, where they put in for the extra time, as the judges, as Your Honors have noticed, and by the testimony of Mr. Silva himself, the representative in this PAGA action. And that's important because the teachings of the Supreme Court in Scott v. Harris is that when an opposing party's story is blatantly contradicted by the record so that no reasonable jury could believe it, summary judgment is proper. And that's exactly the case here. I would say that these affidavits are akin to sham affidavits. I know they're not, and that wasn't what was ruled upon.
Mr. Piasco, isn't that the key to this whole question, what you just said? The standard is whether no reasonable jury could believe it. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, that given all the, well, Judge Smith summarized some of the evidence on the other side that reasonable there's not enough evidence there for the reasonable jury to believe that Domino's, the management of Domino's, had notice that the drivers weren't being compensated for this off-time work. I mean, that's the issue, is that didn't Domino's have notice?
That's correct. Did it have, the only issue here, Judge, is what
you're saying is, you know, you're talking about contradictions, a lot of testimony the other way, but doesn't mean jury has to believe that, does it?
No, Your Honor, but I would respectfully submit that under Anderson and under Celotex and under Scott v. Harris, longstanding precedent here is that the district court sitting on summary judgment has a gatekeeping function here. That gatekeeping function is to ensure that genuine issues of material fact exist or do not. And in this particular case, Judge Selna, and respectfully would submit, properly held that the proof was simply not competent. It was speculative. It was conclusory. And certainly some of it was inadmissible, but that's not on this appeal. But you certainly can't submit in opposition to summary judgment testimony that is entirely contradicted by the affiant's own words and own documents. And that precisely was the case here. And besides that, Judge Tashima, besides that, the evidence was incontrovertible. It was undisputed below that Domino's had the policy. Its PMK, Mr. Villalobos, testified that all these individuals had to do was put it on their timesheet and they would get paid for it. I certainly don't have time to address what I perceive to be really serious mischaracterizations of the record here, but I will make the point, contrary to what my adversary has said, there was at no time did Mr. Silva testify. There's not a single document in this record that Mr. Silva testified that he was told all he's getting is 15 minutes, not one. And there's not a single bit of testimony, not one snippet, that Mr. Silva testified he specifically told managers he was working off the clock, not one. It's just a complete mischaracterization of the record.
I have to change the direction with you briefly on one issue, Mr. Piasco. The claim that Mr. Silva made regarding the provision of wage slips and other documentation seems to be there seems to be some merit to the proposition that wage slips and other documentation should be provided to employees in an integrated fashion. Here, Domino's had a, and I know there's case law which says more than one, and you cited the case law which says more than one document can satisfy California Code Section 226A. But it seems to me what you've got here is a situation in which Domino's provided a wage slip as well as other information that the employee would have to go access on their own online. And that would seem to make a prima facie allegation of a violation of 226. What is it here that wouldn't allow Mr. Silva to get that claim to the jury?
Thank you, Judge Murphy. I think the answer to that is pretty straightforward, Judge. First of all, both the pay stub and the driver detail report, which gives you the granular details of the non-productive time, are available electronically on the same webpage simultaneously at the same time. Mr. Silva admitted that he elected at deposition, Judge Murphy, that he elected for online access and direct deposit. So those documents were simultaneously provided. And those documents, as we addressed in our brief, contain all this information that Section 226A requires, those nine categories. And as we referenced, and I'm sure we'll get there, but as we referenced in our brief, and we cited the Durham case, as well as the Morgan versus United retail case, where the documents show the total hours here, which they do, and all the plaintiff, all Mr. Silva had to do is just add two weekly numbers, literally weekly numbers, A plus B, that is sufficient to satisfy 226A. And he did not have to go to any extrinsic documents in order to figure out whether his hours were correct. They were all right there.
Federal or California appellate authority for that proposition?
Yes, the case is Morgan versus United Retail, 181 Calap 4th, 1136. And I'm sure your honors are familiar with the Rinman versus Sears decision, in which the court gives due respect to an appellate court decision unless it, in its view, is convinced the California Supreme Court would rule otherwise. And I would submit that it would not in this case.
Do you make the same argument that you did to my colleague with respect to the gross wages paid? Are you saying they just needed to add those together and that would be enough?
I'm sorry, Judge, I'm not following.
In other words, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that even though the pay stub broke these down, all he needed to do is add them together and see the total. I also didn't see that there was gross wages paid for the comparable rest and recovery periods. Are you saying that just as you did with respect to the total hours, that all he had to do was to add up the information in two different sources and that would take care of it?
Well, I don't believe that 226A requires a breakdown between the gross wages paid for non-productive work and the total gross wages paid otherwise. Mm-hmm. In this case, Your Honor, these are drivers, commercial drivers exempt under the Motor Carrier Act. They mm-hmm. don't have regular or overtime hours here on a piece rate system. So I don't think that really comes into play, Judge.
But I'm sorry, my question was with respect to gross wages paid, and that would, of course, apply. So in other words, it seems like the gross wages paid was not on some particular form. You would have to go to more than one to get that. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I'll point you to ER 737, which is an exemplar of a pay stub. If Your Honor looks at the middle of the page under total, it does show the total gross wages under earnings.
Got it.
So that number is, in fact, there.
Okay. Let me ask you one other question, which I did your opposing counsel. And that has to do with jurisdiction. In this particular case, my question is there still CAFA jurisdiction when the complaint no longer pleads a class action claim?
I think the answer to that is an unequivocal yes, Your Honor. I would cite the court to Lopez versus Wendy's, 518 Fed Apex 580, which is the Ninth Circuit 2013 decision, in which the court clearly held that post-filing developments after original jurisdiction is invoked do not divest the court of subject matter jurisdiction, as well as Ellison versus AutoZone, similarly a CAFA case in which where all the class claims were dismissed, this court held that the lower court still retained subject matter jurisdiction.
Even when it's a voluntary dismissal of change of the class action?
I think that's correct. And that's exactly what happened in the Archila case versus KFC 420 Fed Apex 667, where the class claims were voluntarily dismissed. The court held similar here, and all that was there in that case, Judge, was a PAGA claim, just like here. The right. court held it was proper for the district court to retain jurisdiction under 1367A3, which, as we cite in our brief, under the U.S. Supreme Court's case Carlsberg Tech, we all know that the Supreme Court has said that it's a purely discretionary. It's purely discretionary on the district court's part whether to retain jurisdiction.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Piesco by my colleagues?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pesco. Mr. Desai, you don't have much time left, but you have what you have. You can use it as you wish.
Just a couple of points. Opposing counsel says that our client never complained to anyone. There's no legal requirement to complain to anyone for a wage and hour violation. He also makes a big deal about how the drivers, including my client, did not keep accurate records. We'd like to say that it is, in fact, the employer's burden to maintain accurate time records, not the other way around. It's a non-delegable duty. You can't just write in a manual that the employee has to keep track of time and then that gets rid of your obligation. It's a non-delegable duty by statute. They also talk a lot about relying upon these timesheets. Well, the timesheets they knew were unreliable. In fact, their own guy says, I don't really believe it. As to the pay stubs, 226.2 does create an obligation for non-productive time. I thank you, unless you have any further questions. That's all I have.
Do either of my colleagues have additional questions for Mr. Desai?
No.
Very well. Thank you both gentlemen for your argument. The case just argued, Silva versus Domino's Pizza, is submitted. I wish you gentlemen a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.